Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It's the second day of July, and aren't we excited about July? Because the first day went really well. 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. We're very happy to have you here, and we have a terrific group. Let me introduce them to you, and we'll get started. Just a reminder, if you'd like to be a part of the conversation, we'd love for you to do that. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org. I will say this at the beginning. I will be more emphatic about it if it turns out to be true. I assume there will be a lot of letters. If there are a lot of letters, then please keep them short and to the point, and then that way we can get to as many as possible. But otherwise, if there aren't a lot of letters, then you can tend to go on a little bit. All right, let's go.
And if you're driving to your vacation, make sure to, hands-free letter writing.
Hands-free letter writing.
Why use two words when 10 will do?
That's right. That's right. It's a good point. Just an all-around, keep it short and to the point, and that helps us out. But it's all good. All right, let me introduce everybody, and we will get started on the news of the day. First of all, I want to welcome public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois back to the program. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Delighted to be here on, I know it's out of fashion, but it's the 1964 on this day in history. President Johnson signed into law the Civil Rights Bill.
Ah.
Right? So happy anniversary to that. May it last another few years. Civil Rights Division didn't make it, but at least maybe the Civil Rights Bill will. Still be somewhat
intact. It was signed today?
Yes.
Signed into law today.
Yep.
Very good. Teresa, thank you. Always good to see you. I was mentioning this to the group before the on-air light ignited, and that was that it's always a good sign when you have a panelist on for the first time and then they come back. That's good. We did something.
Not scare them away.
We did something right. And
still time, Joe.
And especially because we really, really wanted this guy to come back. And Robert Brigham is with us. He's professor of history and international relations at Vassar College, and I'm delighted you are here.
It's good to be here, Joe. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you very much. Same goes for Robert Pondicio, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Robert, always good to see you.
You as well, and proud American, may I also say, 2 days before our nation's birthday.
Yes, absolutely. 4th of July, and we will not be on the air on Friday to celebrate the Day of Independence. We will be here tomorrow, and then we'll have specials on Friday, and then we'll be back on Monday.
But Joe, can I ask the advisory you just gave to the listeners about keeping the letters short? You said something about how you anticipate a lot of letters. Can you say more about that? Does that have something to do with my presence on this broadcast?
Oh, No. If we are
because
talking...
I have tended to attract one or two.
Well, I mean... I don't want to burst your bubble, but
it's not me. I'm grateful.
Oh man, I won't mention any names, but there are certain people who just walk in the door and we get 50 letters.
I'm glad to know I'm not there yet.
No, you're not up to that level. But the day's young, you know.
Okay.
We'll see what happens.
Right.
Who knows? See where you bring us. We'll wait in anticipation. All right, so here we go. This is what to know, and that is that the Senate has passed President Donald Trump's massive tax and immigration bill. This is the big thing we were talking about yesterday. We were wondering, we pondered here on the program with great furrows in our brow as to what way Lisa Murkowski was going to go, and now we have the answers to that. Would it pass? Would it not pass? How would it go? What would the vote be? Would the vice president have to cast the defining vote? And yes, all of that is over now. And well, that was the easy part, right? So now it goes off to the House of Representatives. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act must pass the House. But House Speaker Mike Johnson and his lieutenants have a bumpy road ahead of them to meet their self-imposed July 4th deadline, which I must say I didn't think it was so much their self-imposed deadline. I thought it was President Trump's deadline, but here we go.
And
so go ahead.
Vote, Russ Vogt, because Russ Vogt wants it to go as he's the head of OMB and sort of the mastermind of the Project 2025. And I think their view in Vance is you got to go quick because the more people learn about what's in it, the more unpopular it'll become. So
you do it right around a holiday weekend.
Put everything in one package, make it really hard to understand, do it at a holiday where people are off traveling and see if you can get it through before people realize what's in it.
So the proposal cleared a procedural hurdle in the House Rules Committee early Wednesday, though two GOP members of the panel, Representatives Ralph Norman of South Carolina and Chip Roy of Texas, voted against moving forward. Upset with changes the Senate made to the package, Norman said Tuesday he would vote against the bill in committee unless substantive changes are made. Any change, though, would force the bill back to the Senate, or Congress could convene a conference committee, a group made up of negotiators from both the House and Senate, to hash out remaining differences. If the bill advances unscathed out of the Rules Committee, that panel's determinations about the terms of debate must be approved on the House floor. That will be the legislation's first major test. Fiscal hawks in the past have defeated rules proposals to protest legislation they say adds too much to the national debt. And finally, if the rule is approved, the bill will head for a final approval by the end of the week, which we mentioned is just in 2 days. The process sounds swift. It is not. It can be delayed at numerous junctures by bands of holdouts. There have been several moments in Johnson's speakership when bills appeared to be moving along smoothly, only to be waylaid and subject to frantic renegotiation. Oh, we remember those times. The Senate overhauled the bill by making deeper cuts to Medicaid and allowing energy tax credits to phase out more slowly, among other changes. The Senate parliamentarian, the arbiter of the upper chamber's rules, also stripped out provisions that the House wanted to use to pay for other programs, including provisions that imposed penalties on states' social safety net programs if they provide health coverage to some immigrants. Reading from the Washington Post on this, by the way, those changes have made the bill costlier, excluding borrowing costs. The House version would raise the national debt by $2.4 trillion over 10 years, while the Senate bill increases it by $3.3 trillion. The Senate's changes have angered an array of House Republicans, but Johnson can lose only 3 members of his conference if all lawmakers are present and voting to send the bill to the president's desk. So far, Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky has pledged to vote against the bill. Representative Warren Davidson of Ohio voted against the House bill in May due to deficit concerns, but he has not said he is opposed this time around. The Senate was far more punitive than the House when it came to Medicaid. It imposed stricter limits on the funds that states could draw from certain health care tax provisions and shifted costs for the program from federal to state accounts. There is much more to this, but that is a good place to get us started of a setup to this, of where we are on this Wednesday morning as the House gets ready to vote. And we go to Robert Brigham to begin.
I think Teresa's right. I think the devil's in the details here. And I do see these 23 House Republicans balking at much of that's in this proposal. Roy Arrington himself have already said that they don't like the idea that this bill is going to make the debt as big as our economy. And I don't see any way around that. When you can get into all the specifics, but the fact's a fact. This debt immediately will become as big as the economy. I also think there's something out there that we haven't talked about much in relationship to this bill, and that is the sliding dollar. The dollar has slid by 10% since January. That's the steepest slide since 1973. That's going to affect the way that these Congress people think about this debt, because we're not going to be able to get cheap money. Foreign investment will be affected by this. It's going to cost us more to borrow that kind of money. And the United States is not the safe haven for investment it used to be. Just this week, Many financial houses are starting to increase their European holdings for their stakeholders. So I think there's an awful lot here that when we do get into the specifics are going to be troubling, and in the aggregate are going to be troubling. And it's hard for me to see this getting done in by July 4th.
Robert Appendici.
Oh, hard to add anything to that. That was definitive. But you know, who likes this bill, right? In other words, if you know, coming at this from the right or the center right, massive deficit increase, right? That is unsustainable. I'd not heard the data point before. That is the size of the economy. That is a sobering data point. Let me guess that we're going to start to complain here at this roundtable about the things that are being cut. And I feel like I've said this before on this program, Joe. At some point, we have to make these decisions. We cannot go on like this. So who's going to take the hit here? But it just seems fiscally irresponsible to grow the debt. My goodness, to the size of the economy.
And by 2035, it'll be 135%.
Those of us who have children and grandchildren have to look at this and our blood runs cold.
Teresa Bourgeois.
So some numbers. The debt number, more than $4 trillion. $4 trillion. Dramatically increased from the House version of the bill. So the sort of notion that the Republicans are the fiscally responsible ones and the Democrats aren't has not been true by the data point. If you look at the charts, the Democratic administrations typically reduce the deficits and debt, and the Republicans explode it. The last time Trump did this, historic increase in the debt and deficits, and this will be even worse. So $4 trillion. The one thing I will say is a positive thing is that they did raise the debt ceiling, which unfortunately they're going to need to. They raised it $4 trillion. The reason I think that is positive is because there has been a lot of problems with playing politics with raising the debt ceiling, and that not doing that would really crash the economy. So at least that's off the table if this bill passes. It should be done in a separate bill. I agree with Rand Paul and very little, but that I agree with him on. But they didn't. But that is in there, and to get that done is important. But overall, some more data points. 17 million. That is the number of people who are expected to lose their health insurance. It's a combination of not just Medicaid and the Medicare losses that get triggered because of what's in this bill, but also this bill really chips away at the Affordable Care Act. Speaking of chips, the child health program, people will lose their health benefits there. And then many other people will lose their health benefits just because if you have fewer people in the pool, this is too much detail, but the premiums rise. People can't afford the premiums. So there'll be some others who will, according to the data, lose their health insurance. So 17 million. The top 10% of income distribution, the top 10% get about 80% of the total value of this. So those in the top 10% of income receive about 80% of the value of the benefits in this package. It is the largest transfer of wealth from the bottom to the top in history, according to analysis Yale Budget Lab did.
But is it not also true that the top 10% pays 80% of the taxes?
Oh, long pause.
Yeah, no. They pay a lower percentage of their wage, a far lower percentage
sure,
of their wages.
Sure,
taxes.
Sure, sure. But in terms of their...
But they pay, like, so, you know, the line always that the teacher pays higher taxes or the secretary pays a higher percentage of their income in taxes than the wealthy folks.
Yeah, well,
but the far,
sure.
But the 0.1% of the highest earners get the biggest benefit from the tax breaks in this bill. And the, there was another interesting data point I saw about, reduces disposable income upon the bottom 20% by the same magnitude as it raises disposable income among the top 20%.
Okay. This is and this is your expertise, not mine.
No, this is not my expertise. This is I tried to get it. What I was trying to understand is there's been a lot of detailed talk on the Medicaid cuts, right? But there hasn't, in my view, been as much attention on some of the other things about what is really in these tax cuts. Because they say, the Republicans say, oh, well, if the Democrats don't vote for this, they're voting for tax increases on the working people. Well, what the Democrats try to do with amendment after amendment is separate out, you know, because all the Trump tax cuts are set to expire. Mm-hmm. Well, the Republicans could have done what the Democrats try to do through amendment is that you extend the tax cuts that would benefit working families, lower income families, but you don't extend those that necessarily benefit those at the highest incomes.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
My frustration whenever we have this conversation on the roundtable or elsewhere is just an unwillingness to just take on the spending. In other words, every budget argument tends to eventually sound the same. It's, oh, the tax breaks are going to the wealthy. Well, the wealthy pay the most taxes. Oh, the cuts in services are going to the poor. Well, they're the ones who get the most government services. So that's almost axiomatic. We never seem to want to have the conversation about that massive debt bomb.
Well, so yeah.
What are we going to cut?
So Medicaid. There are ways you can do
this. 1 minute warning. Go ahead.
Sorry. The ways you can do it that they've chosen not to. In fact, you saw Letitia James, the AG in New York, had an announcement yesterday where they did just this. Where's the big money in the problems in Medicaid? It is on the provider side. That's where the big money in the waste, fraud, and abuse is, right? And so under the Clinton administration, they had a team that they put together that focused on addressing the fraud on the provider side of Medicaid. And they found a lot of it. And then that was when the Republicans came in, that was disbanded. Just like in the IRS, the Biden administration put together a group of tax folks who had the skills to focus on the highest income earners who are not paying the taxes that are already on the books. And they collected over $1 billion, right? And then publicizing that then generates more. Republicans aren't doing that. That was longer than a minute.
No, it was you came in right in on time. But I'm sorry to report your minute is up, but that's okay. We have 90 more when we return. We'll take a break. We will be back. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion as we mentioned the bill that was passed by the Senate yesterday now goes on to the House. And the vote that made the biggest difference yesterday was that of Senator Lisa Murkowski, a Republican of Alaska, who cast the deciding vote for President Trump's sprawling bill to slash taxes and social safety net programs, embracing a measure that she acknowledged would harm Americans after securing carve-outs to protect her constituents from its harshest impacts. I don't know if anyone saw it. She was interviewed on NBC News, and she was just seething. I have never seen I've never seen an interview like that. I've done a lot of interviews, and I've never seen anyone just answer the questions and just seething the entire time. But she said, "Do I like this bill? No." And she said, but I try to take care of Alaska's interests, but I know that in many parts of the country, there are Americans that are not going to be advantaged by this bill. For weeks, Ms. Murkowski, the moderate fourth-term senator who has criticized Mr. Trump and has long been a swing vote in her party, had expressed concerns about the cuts to Medicaid and SNAP food assistance contained in the bill. It would impose strict new work requirements for both programs and reduce the federal contribution to their costs. But with Mr. Trump demanding quick action and Republicans facing a tight vote margin in the Senate, Ms. Murkowski wielded unique leverage with party leaders to insist on changes. Republicans stuffed the bill with all sorts of goodies designed to win her over, including a provision that would allow certain Alaskan whaling captains to deduct more of their expenses. Thank God the world can spin easier on its axis this morning.
Somewhere Al D'Amato smiles.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. So I read that, and I would like that for conversation. I also want to throw in Barbara's letter, a listener who says, so to appease Murkowski, the Senate settled on giving a two-year exemption to states with the highest rates of either overpaying or underpaying SNAP benefits. In addition to Alaska, this shields 10 other states that also made frequent mistakes from having to pay higher costs. Does this mean New York can systematically underpay for benefits and get more federal funds? Because this is a bizarro world, says Barbara.
Well, this gets to what we were talking about just before the break, which is the right way to cut and not cut, right? Because it's a disincentive to run a well-managed SNAP program. But I want to talk about this whole concern about her agonizing. You know, I'm more worried about the family who is going to agonize over how they're going to pay their electric bill, because those electric bills are going up. They were going to go up anyway, but now when you halt the focus on clean energy, on solar and wind that was going to add to the power to the electric grid, and you disincentivize that, then the electric bills are going to go up further faster. There are going to be agonizing choices for families as food prices go up, because in addition to this bill, there's a lot of other things going on, including the ending of the USAID program, which ended yesterday. $2 billion of that came, you know, for U.S. farmers from the U.S. agriculture sector, right? So if you have the cuts in SNAP programs that benefited farmers, if you have cuts in USAID that benefited farmers, you have the pressure on tariffs that's hurting farmers. This is a real assault on the agriculture community, particularly our family farms. Food prices are likely going to go up, and that's going to affect families who are going to have to make agonizing choices about what to pay. There's going to be agonizing choices around health care and how you get access to health care as the premiums going up. So this is going to cause a whole series of agonizing choices for people. So I'm not quite so worried about Murkowski. I'm worried about the average working families who are now going to have to face some really hard choices.
Joe, I think we're facing a perfect storm here. You know, this sliding dollar, this increasing debt, the tariff policy seems completely out of line with that. They get the history wrong on this, first of all. McKinley, Trump always says, was a brilliant businessman. He was no businessman. He was a lawyer. And he was only in favor of tariffs in the 1896 election. And then by 1900, he was an anti-tariff man. He became a trade man because he understood that those American industries needed to be protected early because the British were overinvested in America. Mm. Almost all the railroads were built by British investment. But once that balance was straightened out after the war with Spain, caused in part by a sugar tariff, then McKinley became a trade person. Trade is going to be much more difficult with these higher tariffs and a sliding dollar. I just heard this morning that the hiring in private sector has declined in this last quarter for the first time in years. All of this just seems to me that we're going to be in a world of hurt by Labor Day.
You know that. Can you speak more to that? I heard on the way in about the jobs report that seemed really unsettling. Am I right about that?
You are right. It's not the official report, but
that's
they always come out with this report a week before the official report. And hiring in the private sector has declined for the first time in many years.
Tracy, you and I might not agree on very much, but I'm with you on Murkowski. This is not exactly profiles in courage, is it? In other words, she's getting her pork for her district and then wringing her hands and saying, woe is me, and I hope the House votes the bill down. Not exactly profiles in courage, right?
Well, the disincentives, right? You were talking earlier about we've got to find cuts. We've got to find ways to do these programs better.
Not only is she having her cake and eating it too, she's getting a lot of cake that her constituents will get to eat, and then at the same time criticizing the entire package.
Don't forget the whaling captains.
I'm sure the fishermen on a Gloucester would like that as well.
Yeah. Let them eat cod.
But the ripple effect that this has, right? Sorry, I'm ignoring the whole thing.
It was a good one though.
I was thinking about all the whaling. I was going and I just. you know, whatever.
I understand.
I'm not a funny person. I'll let you do that part. I wish I were funny, but funny, how funny starts. Anyway, but you were talking earlier about, well, what are we going to do about containing costs, right? So one of the things that you do in the SNAP program is that you incentivize efficiency, right? Make sure it goes to the right people.
That was really eye-opening.
This is exactly the opposite, right? So they have programs. They put a program in that incentivizes efficiency, and this drives states to purposefully run a program that has a high, what they call, error rate, meaning, and you know, as somebody pointed out, the error rate is in both directions.
Yes, yeah, overpay
so
or underpay.
So if you overpay somebody, right, then you go back and further down in the year, they're going to get a lower amount on their card, on their debit card, because they were overpaid. And they don't even know that they were overpaid, but all of a sudden, there's no money for food on their card.
I have to confess that nuance was, it's not a nuance, it's a big number. That was completely lost upon me. I had no idea that's how they did the math.
But this is not how you make the system better. Just like not having teams in place to go after Medicaid fraud. Yeah. That's not how you make the system better. There are ways to contain these costs. There are ways, job training programs. Mm-hmm. You slash job trainings. You want to have more people employed at higher wage jobs. There's all sorts of need in this country for, I talked about this the other day, for welders and electricians and that whole, you know, gamut of folks. They're wiping out the support programs for that kind of training. The Biden folks really, in conjunction with their infrastructure bill and their clean energy bill, they had a corresponding effort to try to make sure you had the prepared workforce for that. Right?
I suspect. How do you feel about the work requirements in the bill for Medicaid and SNAP?
I think that
apropos of making things better.
So in theory, it's important that able-bodied people who are able to work do that. But if you look at the issue of how, so Arkansas tried this, right? Conservative government,
Bill Clinton
conservative,
tried it
straight. Even under Republican governors, they tried this. And what they found was that it costs more money to try to implement it than you saved, right? So in theory, it sounds good, but in fact, it's hard to do because people have complicated lives.
Sure.
Just like these paperwork, the paperwork stuff is nothing, but you know, some people call them their paper cuts, that they are paperwork designed to cut people off the program because the paperwork becomes so cumbersome. So they cut the number of people who are administering the paperwork. So it's very hard to reach people. It's very hard to understand. And it's a backdoor way of driving people off the rolls.
Yeah.
So generally, in theory, it's good for people to work. That's why I worry about cutting the job training programs, because you need the skilled labor. Business needs the skilled labor. If you get people employed in higher skills, they have higher wages, so they won't need the SNAP benefits. But they're eliminating the funding for all these programs. But these kinds of investments are what makes a difference.
Well, surely job training can be done by somebody other than the feds, right? But back to the, you know, the work requirements.
But it's often done by unions, but you have to incentivize it and you have to coordinate with the manufacturers and unions about looking ahead. We did this when I was dealing with a program like this in Michigan. You have to look 4, 5, 6, 8 years down the road to see what are the skills that are going to be needed.
Yeah.
And so you're creating pipelines. We did it in Boston too, create pipelines so you have the skills. You need phlebotomists. You got to be training phlebotomists.
Yeah. The point I was going to make is, having already outed myself as a bit of a fiscal hawk, every now and then there are going to be aspects of this that are going to make me think, well, what are the incentives here? What is the kind of country that we want? So I'm glad we agree on that. All things being equal, we do want people to work as opposed to not work. So the argument that it costs more is not necessarily persuasive to me in that particular instance.
Well, if it's not, the thing is, can I design a system that's effective?
Sure.
Right. And it has to be flexible enough so it might appear that a person isn't able-bodied, should be able to work, but he or she may have some family constraints, so they might be taking care of a person at home, where it's less expensive for the government and better for the person if you have a family member taking care of the person at home. But if they're taking care of the person at home, they can't go to work, right? So it has to have that flexibility. But in any case.
Fair enough.
But back to what's in the bill.
And?
Well, on the, you know, less...
Actually, let me hold you there. Let's take a break, and then we'll go into what's in the bill. And we'll go to letters. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, 9:48 on this Wednesday morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Just before we went to a break, we were talking about, because Teresa brought this up, of what is in the bill. So give us an idea, Teresa, of how you see this.
Well, I just think about what the Trump folks keep saying, well, this is what the American people voted for. This is what they want. This is what we're going to do. So there's a broad range, as we've talked about a lot, is the Medicaid cuts and Medicare cuts. I don't think that people voted to have higher health care premiums and to lose their health care coverage. What's interesting is that the Medicaid cuts don't go into effect until after the midterm elections. And so while we'll know it's coming, it won't happen. Now, the cuts to the Affordable Care Act go into effect at the end of the year. And so people will know right away. They have very significant increase in premiums. But I don't think, and then you think about these health care cuts that are in the bill in combination with the dismantling of the public health system, the cuts to neighborhood health centers in this bill is the cuts to funding for Planned Parenthood, which does a lot of prenatal care. You know, it's a health care provider for a lot of people. And so the other thing is, I talked about there, I don't think that the Americans voted to weaken the food systems, the food delivery systems in our country. And I think there's a lot in this bill that does that. The cuts in SNAP, for instance, but also in combination with the immigration raids on farms. I've talked about this already. The cuts to, oddly enough, the cuts to NOAA, the cuts to clean energy on farms. There's a whole series of cuts and disincentives that will impact our food systems. There's a whole series. Now, I will say on the university system, there's a troubling provision in this bill that on the Senate side would have taxed endowments for universities at 21%, up from 1.7 to 21%. The Senate bill lowers that, I believe, to 7 or 8%.
It's based on a per student endowment. So it's going to be a sliding scale for all schools with endowments.
Right. And I know I just got data from Harvard because that's where I did my graduate. It was going to be very serious for Harvard. But again, this for universities in combination with the restrictions on foreign students coming to the United States, making it harder for them to do it, with the very deep cuts in research funding for universities and on. It's really a part of an overall attack on universities. And then the other thing that's in this bill that I think is troubling is the amount of money for the deportation campaign. $46 billion for building the wall. Now, didn't President Trump say Mexico was going to pay for that? $46 billion. $45 billion for private prisons to increase the number of beds by detention beds by $100,000. And you saw the news yesterday of the facility in Florida that sprung up. And that's going to cost $1.2 million a day to operate. $1.2 million per day.
Alligator Alcatraz.
I'm not calling
as it
that.
Is called.
And on so many levels, it's reprehensible. And on so many levels, you talk about saving money. You know, why that approach to detention? Why do that? It's performative and it's cruel. And it doesn't even make sense. Why would you put people in tents in a swamp in Florida during hurricane season. It's a recipe for disaster, and it's a costly recipe. You know, you want to cut. I'm sorry, I'm going to. I'm still thinking about you saving money, and then I'm going to stop talking. I've got a ton of these, but you want to save money? Why are they still letting the Pentagon pay billions of dollars for that Trump plane from Kuwait for the federal government to fix that plane so that it'll become Trump's possession after he leaves? You want to save money? Try there.
That's a rounding error. And it's not even a rounding error. If we're talking about stuff that's in the bill that we like, I haven't seen a word of coverage about this. But in my little demimonde in the education world, this is all we're talking about. And I'll admit that I may be the only person on this panel who likes this. But there is a federal tax credit, a school choice tax credit that the Senate took out. It has been restored, I believe, by the parliamentarian. And it is now in the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. A couple of times ago when I was on the roundtable, I talked about education savings accounts and how we don't realize this in blue states, but, you know, in more than half the country now has the ability, it's a universal education savings account in red states where parents can take the money that would have been spent on educating their kids in the public system, opt out of the public system, take the money with them in the form of a savings account, functionally a voucher, although it can be used for a lot more things than just private school tuition. Well, there's a tax credit scholarship fund in the bill that could fund scholarships for up to 2 million students, which would double the number of private school choice programs. Now, I happen to like that. I realize others do not. But that is definitely a benefit for low and middle income families.
Well, actually, doesn't the data show that that tends to be used by higher income families?
Sure.
Going to private schools? The majority of those funds will go to higher income students who are already sending their kids.
Just like rich families.
Who know how to access
it. Sure. Just like rich families bought most of the cars in 1903.
Right. Well, but it will be pulling resources. You know, we know that the schools have problems. It'll be pulling resources out of the public schools and shifting them to private schools and being used by the people who otherwise have the ability to pay.
This is one of those things that you and I most definitely will not
agree
on. I have no illusions about that, but as a former, you know, South Bronx public school teacher, I have a very difficult time arguing that those families who've been failed generation after generation should not have some other opportunity for their kids to learn.
Bob? Yeah, I think that this is all really interesting to me, and I think that the working people in this country are going to suffer under this bill. It's interesting to me, other things that aren't in this bill that will affect New Yorkers and other states that have high property tax are the limits of the write-offs for tax exemptions. Mm. That was something that Mike Lawler and a whole bunch of New Yorkers in the House were really keen on getting in this bill, raising that ceiling, and it's not been raised.
40 down to 10.
Yeah, 40 down to 10. And that, I think, you know, if the House members will pull, you know, situationally, item by item, that they can't fathom, this may be harder to get through the House than Trump thinks.
The other thing that's in there is at the same time they are cutting incentives for clean energy for solar and wind. Interestingly, the Senate took out retained the incentives for geothermal, which I thought was interesting. So somebody must have cared about geothermal. But they took out the tax incentives for solar and wind, but they kept it for geothermal. But also they added an increased tax incentives for oil and gas. So there are already tremendous tax incentives and for oil and gas, but they added to it. And the other thing is this gun provision. This they took away a tax on some guns. I'm sorry, I need to look up the details on that, but I thought that was...
I was really surprised that more members of the Senate and House Armed Services Committee and Foreign Affairs Committees didn't raise objections to the way that renewables are being used. Renewables at this stage of the game are strategic, and China is buying our lunch on this. And I think people who study foreign policy a lot are worried that we've put all of our effort into fossil fuels. this is going to be a strategic concern, and I'm just surprised it didn't get raised at all.
The other thing in the military, folks, is there's tremendous amount of money in here, tremendous increase for the Defense Department. But as I read it, as I understand it, the vast majority is for systems, weapon systems, as opposed to for the troops.
Yeah, and some of those weapon systems the Defense Department has been consistently against,
right.
But they're going to be shoved down their throat
right.
by this bill.
That there are some improvements for the troops, but the vast majority, if you look at Military Times and others, they say the vast majority, and it is skewed toward the weapon systems as opposed to the people. And for ICE, it's more than tripling the ICE budget. And what's going on around the country with ICE, do we really want that budget tripled?
Well,
the deportation budget?
Back to budget cuts. If we're looking for savings, I'm fairly hawkish militarily, but we just had one of the most successful military maneuvers in our nation's history in Iraq.
Oh, I'd back off of that statement if I was you. After battle assessment doesn't say that at all.
let's agree to disagree on that one. At least
no, I won't. I don't agree to disagree.
I don't think the facts are in yet.
Then why would you say that was one of the most successful military strikes
because
in history.
The facts aren't in yet. That's really
it's way premature.
Did the ceasefire fall apart? Did I miss that?
Well, let's
three strikes
because
in history.
The facts aren't in yet. That's really
it's way premature.
Did the ceasefire fall apart? Did I miss that?
Well, let's go back why we needed it in the first place.
Does Iran have a nuclear weapon? Did I miss that?
Well, they're close.
Hey, Ray, we may need another hour.
had the Trump not torn up the agreement, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Obama agreement, then we wouldn't be where we were. No, not thank goodness. We wouldn't be where we are, and we would have inspectors and so on and so forth.
Well, the point I was going to make, however, was really on the budget. In other words, we are now in an era, or can we agree on this, where we may need less manpower militarily. That was the point.
No,
I
wouldn't agree with that either.
You would not?
No.
Okay, we'll see.
But also, if you cut research, university-based research.
Let's take a break in a second. Go ahead.
3 seconds.
Finish your thought, but go ahead.
It's bad for the defense.
All right. We'll end there. We'll take a break when we come back.
How are those Mets doing?
We'll get to all the...
I must have had a bad Mets night. Ray. He left.
I think Ray just gave Teresa the finger.
He gave me two of them.
Yeah, two. Wow. Two. Okay.
Where'd he go?
Anyway, we'll take a break, and the lovable Ray Graham will be with us first. Little Peter Frampton action on the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, and we appreciate you. I mentioned earlier we didn't know how many letters we were going to get. Well, we got a lot, so we'll get to as many of those as we possibly can. Let me just remind you who's on our program this morning. Teresa Bourgeois is here, public policy and communications expert. Bob Brigham, professor of history and international relations at Vassar College and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio, joins us as well. Bob, Robert was telling us a story during the break about, so your daughter asked you what you would be asked what you did for a living.
Yeah, this was when I worked at Business Week magazine. I was the director of public affairs there for several years, and I had a lot of televisions in my office because it was my job to be, focused on what the media is doing.
What's going on?
So somebody asked my little daughter, she was 4 years old, what does your dad do for a living? And she said, he watches television.
Now, the reason I caught that was because, and this was a great mystery in my family, it still is, I guess, but I was asked in school, in kindergarten, what my dad did for a living, and my father worked for the federal government. He worked for, at that point, Health Education and Welfare, and they said, Joe, what does your dad do? And I said, he collects bird nests.
Hey, I do that now.
and I don't really ever remember my dad collecting birds,
it wasn't one of his hobbies?
No, I don't know where it came from.
Didn't realize I could get paid. I'm going to turn pro.
Yeah, that's right. Not
Are
bad.
Are you a birder?
Isn't this a cliche? You get to a certain age. There's comedy routines about this, and suddenly you get develop an interest in birds. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true.
There's a whole birder subculture that I think is
No. I'm not that crazy person who wanders around in swamps.
It's fabulous.
It is, but you know.
But it's not you.
Do you have the binoculars?
You have the book that tells you. Have the thing, an app on your phone?
Yeah, the book. Those are the tells.
The book, the app.
The book, the hat.
I will out my wife, who has a... look, I'm worse.
You're in trouble later.
She keeps...
Blame your wife.
I hope she's not listening. She keeps data. She's got a chart by our window where she charts when the birds come and go.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we have become those people who just pay attention to birds because, you know, we're getting on in years and it's the law.
It's the law. All right, we have a lot of letters. Let's get to them. And we start with Andrew. Your starting premise is wrong. The cruelty is the point. All the fiscal pretensions, which are demonstrably false, they will save the country money, are meant to benefit the currently rich and punish the present and future poor and vulnerable. Anyone who pretends otherwise is lying. That from Andrew. We then go to Theo. School choice is a bad idea all around. There is no choice, quote unquote, for special needs children. Taken to the extreme, the public schools will be hollowed out, leaving them only for special needs children and no money to deal with them. Do you want to say anything quick about that, Robert?
I've spent 25 years in education, and if I thought we could get where we needed to get for the kids that I care about, who are low-income kids of color in places like the South Bronx where I used to teach, I would be in favor of it. I was a public school, staunch public school guy when I started my career. I'd never even heard of a charter school. If we were going to get it done with the institutions and funding streams that we have, we're spending $40,000 a year per kid in New York City. If that was going to solve the problem, it would have been solved by now. At the very least, we have to have an appetite for something other than telling people, be patient, we're working on it. How many generations are we going to continue to say that to people?
Anybody else? Okay, let's go back to the letters. And
I'm going to restrain.
You shut down the room.
No, Robert. I want to hear more letters, so I'm going to contain myself.
Let me just try to zero my...
Well, while you do that, I'll think about the charter. A former boss of mine in Boston, he felt that there needed to be better schools, but he created a private school but didn't take money from public schools.
Yeah. By the way, I am not anti-public school at all.
Because he didn't want to drain money away from public schools, but he did create an option, and it was for low-income families, so they gave them a pathway to access it, but they did it without draining resources from the public schools. So it can be done, but you don't have to drain resources from the public school.
And I don't want to divert us, but my argument for years has been, look, we socialize the cost of public education because, you know, you pay your school taxes whether you have 10 kids, one or none. We socialize that cost because we are invested in the outcome of every single child. It does not matter to me. You cannot make me care about whose roof that happens under as long as that outcome is achieved.
All right. We go to Chris. I often hear that the voters didn't vote for this, the big, beautiful bill. I disagree. They voted for Trump and Republican House and the Senate. The Republicans have been going after health care coverage for since Obamacare. They have not hid their agenda. So, yes, the folks that voted Republican in 2024 indeed did vote for this.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Thank you very much. But even up to, I believe, yesterday, President Trump was still parroting the lie that there are no Medicaid cuts in this bill. And it's a lie. Also, there are billions and billions of dollars in this for his deportation campaign, and that is built on a lie. The lie that that other countries, Venezuela and other countries, emptied their prisons and their jails and their mental health facilities and sent all those violent criminals to the United States, and that they're violent criminals running around, and that's who they're going to deport. 7% of the people that they have picked up so far in this Trump deportation campaign, 7% by their own data, have violent criminal histories. The vast majority do not. And I think that the truth lies in what J.D. Vance said at a recent political dinner, which is that we've got to deport these people because he said it's all about the voters, that we persuade our voters, but the Democrats are trying to import our voters, and we've got to get them out of the country.
So I want to go on to some more letters. I just want to mention that yesterday, for those of you who have been following the Sean Diddy Combs trial in federal charges in Manhattan, the jury reached a verdict on 4 out of the 5 charges. They came back deadlock on the 5th. The judge said, go back, try again. They recessed last night. They came back this morning, and they've just announced that a verdict has been reached on all counts, and we'll read the verdict a little bit in just a little bit, and we'll bring that, we'll mention that to you when we find out. All right, let's go back to the letters. Barbara says, my dad is 102 years old. Well, aww. God bless both of you. He lives at home needing 24/7 care. It has taken me a year to get Medicaid approved. So many levels of agencies and people and pooled trusts, impossible for the average person to wade through. I don't believe anyone could cheat the system. Boy, that's a point. I'll tell you, you know, it takes, talk about taking a village to raise a child. It takes a village to figure out if you are older, and I'll just leave it at that, older, and are trying to figure all that stuff out, and you don't have a team, and hopefully one of your children is a lawyer, it's really hard.
This is why this notion of recertifying every 6 months, at the same time they are eliminating staff to assist and cutting the time periods and stuff, this recertification every 6 months when it takes people over a year to get certified, that's why people are so distraught.
Let's go to Barbara. Thank you very much for your
great letter
and
for your work.
Yeah.
And hi to your dad.
And yeah, hi to your
102.
Dad. 102.
Right.
That's fabulous.
Terrific. Lisa, schools are instrumental in job training. Trump's decision to cut educational funding will seriously impair job training at secondary schools. We're going to talk a little bit more about that story coming up in just a little bit. I also want to get to Marilyn, who says Republicans still believe in the myth of the welfare queen. They think anyone needing help are freeloaders. That from Maryland. Then we go to Barb. Lisa Murkowski did exactly what she was elected to do, work for her constituents. She was not there to necessarily save districts in New York or anywhere else. Why aren't you more upset with the likes of Elise Stefanik, who spends her time kissing up to Trump? Elise bragged she was the deciding vote in the House before it went to the Senate. That from Barb. Don't worry. I think we have plenty of time to still be upset. It's just we were talking about the Senate. As soon as the House turns around, don't worry.
But I do think some senator like Josh Hawley, who talked about how terrible this was and then turned around and voted for it, right? There are other people in that category.
But if you don't think this bill is terrible, who doesn't think this bill is terrible?
I mean, that's a great. Yeah.
Who in their heart of hearts or who publicly, right? I mean, in the cloakroom where they're all talking to each other for real, I think they think what's going on is nuts.
No, it's a question of why you think it's terrible, but
I do think, I mean, Lindsey Graham, look at him, you know, full embrace. Yeah, the Republican senators, but there's so many. Oh, you know, Texas got its own little incentives. They get in the deportation campaign money. There's a huge tranche of money targeted just for Texas.
Well, here's an idea. Let's retire the debt by taxing hypocrisy.
Carrie says the following people like the bill: Stephen Miller, Kristi Noem, for the billions more for detention facilities and ICE arrests, Russell Vogt of the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, and everyone behind Project 2025, who all want the federal government to totally go away by starving it of money. 3, the very richest of the rich. That from Kerry. Let us go now to the story I just teed up a moment ago, and that was about school funding withheld. The president announced yesterday, or the White House announced, to be more
specific, the Trump administration has declined to release nearly $7 billion in federal funding that helps pay for after-school and summer programs, support for students learning English, teacher training, and other services. The money was expected to be released by yesterday. But in an email on Monday, the Education Department notified state education agencies that the money would not be available. The administration offered little explanation, saying only that the funds were under review. It gave no timeline for when or if the money would be released, saying instead that it was committed to ensuring taxpayer resources are spent in accordance with the president's priorities. The frozen funds are unrelated to the millions of dollars in cuts included in the domestic policy bill that squeaked through the Senate on Tuesday. So there is that difference. It's catastrophic, said Jody Grant, executive director of the After School Alliance, a group that works to expand after school services for students. She estimates that the federal dollars for after school and summer school programs, about $1.3 billion annually, support 1.4 million students, mostly lower income, representing about 20% of all students in after-school programs nationally. The move is likely to be challenged in court and has already been criticized as illegal by Democrats and teachers' unions. Bob, given your educational background, we'll start with you.
Oh, man. Have you all heard of Gell-Mann amnesia syndrome? Do you know what this is? It's it's named after Murray Gell-Mann, the physicist. Don't ask me why. But it's this phenomenon where you're reading the paper and you come across an article about which you have intimate knowledge and you realize, oh, my goodness, that's completely wrong. That's not how this works at all. And the amnesia syndrome is you then turn the page and read about something that you know nothing about, you know, Wall Street or the Middle East or whatnot, and you forget you had this experience a moment ago where the newspaper was covering a topic you know and you realize they got it wrong. You assume they get everything else right. So I'm having Gell-Mann amnesia syndrome this morning when I read this piece.
Coined by novelist Michael Crichton,
that's right.
In 2009. To naming it after Murray Gell-Mann, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist with whom he had discussed the phenomenon.
There you go.
I yield the floor.
So I read this piece, and I think, well, hold on a second. First of all, you know, Congress authorized this, so, you know, you can hold on to these dollars, but eventually, whether it's through a lawsuit or whatnot, these dollars will be released. Do you know what percentage of the education spending, public education spending in this country, is from the feds? 8%, 92% is state and local. Do you know what percent this represents? Less than 1%. So how did we get to a point where it's a catastrophe, a disaster? What was the other quote that you read, Joe? If you are so badly mismanaging your money that I think the exact figure is 0.8% of your funding is a catastrophe, something has gone very, very wrong. So when are we going to talk about not just the federal spending, but the effect of the spending? When are we going to talk about ELLs? In other words, the tenor of this piece
what
is
ELL means?
Oh, sorry, English language learners.
Okay,
migrant education. The way it's put here, it's gone down. You know, the more money we spend on it, the worse it gets. ELL or second language learning is in terrible shape. You know, again, I do education policy, so stop me if I'm going on about this. But if you look at, education spending has roughly tripled in the 50 years that we have had the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, as it's commonly called, the nation's report card. And NAEP looks like a dead man's EKG. It has not budged despite the fact that we have tripled spending. But yet we get these steady drumbeats of stories. Oh, my goodness, the sky is falling. They're cutting funding. Are we ever going to talk about what we are getting for this investment? We're getting things that not only does the spending doesn't improve outcomes, it's getting worse. Where is that story?
Good question. Anyone else on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the details here are significant and important, but I'm concerned, too, about the principle. Yes, it's true that the courts are going to use the Empowerment Control Act, probably, and overturn this.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, other presidents have done exactly this.
And the money will come back. The issue for me is the process here. They're going to use rescission, and rescission for something that's already been appropriated by Congress and approved by the president The court always sides with the fundees, but it's a process that opens up all sorts of problems, I think, for this administration and for other issues in funding. It's just not how this should be done.
Just real quick on the Sean Combs trial, the hip-hop mogul was convicted on Wednesday of two counts of transportation to engage in prostitution after an eight-week trial, but a federal jury in Manhattan acquitted Mr. Combs of the most serious charges against him, sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy, in a case that accused the famed producer of coercing women into unwanted sex with male prostitutes, aided by a team of pliant employees. And I'm sure there will be more on that story as the day progresses and on our news magazine programs, Midday Magazine and NPR as well. All right. Anyone else? Yes, back to school funding.
So I think there's two tracks of this that are important that, you know, you've both. So one of them is whether or not this is a problem, a serious problem or not for these frontline folks. And from my experience, these frontline folks operate at the margins. It may be 0.08% of the federal budget. I'm sure it's much, much more minuscule than that. But that doesn't mean it's not a very large percentage of the Boys and Girls Club budget that they were anticipating it, right? So up until 2 days ago, 3 days ago, they were anticipating receiving this funding. It's not as if they're told a year ahead, next summer, you're not going to have this funding. This is funding that was awarded to them, that they planned, that parents or guardians are anticipating their kids are involved in these programs. So not only are they educational, but in fact, it becomes the daycare, you know, who's watching your kids while you're working, right? And so there are a lot of ramifications for pulling this funding at the last minute. If you pull this funding a year in advance and then they have the capacity to raise the money elsewhere, maybe. But to pull back funding that has been awarded with no notice, except for at the last minute when these programs are starting, summer programs, I think that that's a very serious problem. It may not seem like a big deal to you, but as a person who got funding for these kinds of programs and worked with these very frontline community groups who always operated on the margins, they depended on these dollars. And if they said the dollars are coming, then they depended on the dollars coming. And if the day before the kids started coming, the dollars stopped coming, then they, where are they going to scramble to find the money for the program? And then I'll just, also agree with Bob that there is a problem here with this administration that is not following the Constitution. They are not following the separation of powers. They are doing this in program after program after program. And Vogt had said they are going to, and Vance, they are trying to push the limits of executive power as far as they can push them. Test this in the courts. Better ask permission than forgiveness. The courts rule that they have to pay it back. But look at with USAID. Eventually, the courts are going to rule what they did with USAID is illegal. But in the meantime, the staff has been completely dismantled. And as the Lancet, there was a study came out in Lancet Journal yesterday about the millions of people who are going to die as a result of this. Right. And Rubio keeps saying, Secretary Rubio, nobody's going to die. Nobody's going to die. Well, they are going to die. I'm sorry. I'm switching. But this is happening. It's happening to grants for community-based policing. It's happening to violence prevention for women's grants. It's happening to vaccine program grants. It's happening to housing grants. It's happening all across the board where these grants, in the bill that was passed the Senate yesterday for solar projects, the projects are underway. They've been given grants to do these projects, and they're pulling back the unspent money. So a project could be halfway in the ground, and they're going to have that money pulled back. How are they going to finish that project?
All right. We only have 2 minutes, but I want to get to everybody.
This won't take 2 minutes. But the other thing that's missing from this, you know, a sky is falling piece in the New York Times is the fact that this has happened under Democratic presidents as well. Within my career, Obama withheld Race to the Top dollars under ESEA to make sure he liked the way that the states were going to spend the money. Biden withheld money from the American Rescue Plan from schools to ensure COVID compliance.
After awarded?
Yes.
When they were anticipating the program to begin.
Let me not say that definitively. Because, you know, I tend to do...
Yeah, I don't think so.
School finance is not my area of expertise. The Clinton administration did this as well. So, in other words, let's not pretend that this is unique. And again, the Congress authorizes these dollars, whether it takes a court action or this is just a temporary review, these dollars will get allocated. I also think this is a multi-year funding cycle, so I'm not sure, Teresa, that you're correct.
The summer programs of the Boys and Girls Clubs are
operating on money, I believe, from the last cycle. I could be wrong about that. Again, finance, school finance is not my thing, but I'm fairly sure it's a 30-month cycle.
I just know what I read from the Boys and Girls Clubs, and they get these programs, and the money was expected to pay for this year, and it's not. And I think that what the Obama people did, I think, is that they didn't issue the RFPs. They didn't put out the grants. It's not that grants were awarded and they pulled them back after awarded.
There was money allocated that was not being dispersed.
It was not. Right, because they didn't have the grant programs, but they didn't award grants and then pull money back.
All right. Bob, do you have a 30-second reply?
No, I don't.
You do not. All right. We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue for our final countdown here. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. It's the 2nd of July, and thank you very much for being with us. All right. Let us go. Does anybody have anything else that they want to mention about school funding withheld? Story, the school funding withheld story. Okay.
Not I.
Make sure that has been
picked clean.
Yes, that's right. Picked clean, indeed. All right, let's go to the Hochul poll. I think this is interesting. The New York governor, Kathy Hochul, has a strong lead over Republican and Democrat challengers, according to a Siena College poll, a strong leader over potential challengers in the 2026 race for governor. And this is interesting for a couple of reasons. One is that it shows her leading within her party, Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado, who broke with Hochul and said that he would that he was going to leave the ticket and would run against her.
Not leave the job, though.
That's correct. He is still our Lieutenant Governor.
Kids got to eat.
And that's right.
He's got cute kids.
So that is one thing. The word on Delgado for a long time has been that people do not know who he is outside of his congressional district when he was in Congress. And certainly I think most people would agree in this room that if you want to greatly increase your profile and being known, Lieutenant Governor may not be the best way to do it. Just saying.
Well, Kathy Hochul was Lieutenant Governor, but you know, choose your governor wisely.
I'm taking it straight, but interesting thing about Kathy Hochul when she was lieutenant governor is that Cuomo clearly completely shut her out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And she could have just been on the side and bitter, mm-hmm. but instead she just went around the state working through his regional economic development councils, right? Meeting after meeting after meeting. And it was under the media radar screen, really, except for local media. Yeah. And she ended up really learning the state and making all these connections with the economic development and the community folks all around the state. So I thought that was a pretty interesting.
But to Joe's point, before Cuomo imploded, what percentage of New Yorkers do you think could have picked Kathy Hochul out of a police lineup?
No. I don't disagree with that at all. But I thought that she strategically, she found herself in a challenging situation, and she strategically made good use of it, publicly, but strategically, so that then she's well known by these key people all around the state.
Well,
that's the only point.
You don't climb the greasy pole by being being a dummy.
You know, I just thought it was interesting that she did that.
The polls this early are problematic in general. But especially in New York.
People aren't even like really running.
They are. And, but especially in New York, where you have 48% of registered voters are affiliated as Democrats, 21% as Republicans, but 26% as unaffiliated. Yeah. And they're generally not going to show up in these kind of polls. So it's too early and not really meaningful.
And apropos of which, I think we're kind of burying the lead here in discussing this poll, right? Rather than talk about the head-to-head, the data point that I think matters most, if I'm Hochul, 42% of New Yorkers rate her favorable, 47% unfavorable. I don't want to run for re-election when I'm underwater. And 55% prefer someone else, as opposed to 30% of voters who say they want to re-elect her. This is not a good poll for her.
No, but I will say, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but those polls usually seem to be all over the place.
Oh, sure.
That's how you ask the question, too.
It's a year and a half away.
Yeah.
It's too premature.
Yeah. And, but... So I do want to get to Elise Stefanik, who has not officially announced yet, but certainly is seems to be very close and has hinted at this over the last several weeks, but has a clear lead among Republicans in a three-way primary, garnering 35% of the vote if she were to run against Mike Waller. And also Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman. So that is where it stands at the moment. But as you mentioned, Hochul would also do best when matched with Stefanik. The poll found she would win with 47% of the vote in that scenario compared to 24% for Stefanik. The incumbent governor also would have no problem defeating Waller or Blakeman. But again, this is what Robert mentioned earlier. This is the numbers for Hochul are not high. Mm-hmm. And when asked if they would prefer to reelect Hochul or someone else, 55% said they would prefer the latter.
Right.
While 37% went for Hochul.
And that could all change tomorrow.
Yes.
Depending on the debate on this bill.
Right.
Well, they're going to have to own it. Lawler and Stefanik are going to have to own this bill if they vote for it. And that's something that that Hochul is not going to have to defend. She's going to get points just by being anti this bill and anti everything that's the hurt that's going to come to working families as a result. So I think I would, you know, all those bad numbers are true. Who do you want to be? I want to be Hochul.
Absolutely.
Well,
just
on the voter registration numbers alone, you want to have a D next to your name as opposed to an R in New York State. That's not going to change. But I'll tell you what, if I'm a Democrat in New York State, I'm looking at recent trends and I'm thinking I cannot be complacent about this. You know, Donald Trump has increased his share of the vote all three times he's run in New York. In 2009, the New York congressional delegation had only two Republicans. What does it have now? 11? In other words, this is a blue state, but it is getting redder, folks.
Maybe.
Data is what it is.
Well, no, that's the current.
The current.
Not the future.
But today's vote. So, you know, let's get back to today's vote because there are five votes. New York State Republicans, if they voted the interest of their state, which is to vote no on this bill, go back to the drawing board, let's fix it, because it could be fixed, right? There could be changes that could improve this bill so it's not as painful for New York State. If they voted no, this bill would go down, right? If Lawler voted no and Langworthy voted no and a few others voted no who said they care deeply about, and the Long Island folks helped me with the names, right? If they voted no, this bill would go down, right? Now, they're not going to do that, but if they did, I mean, and if ever you're going to do something and you want to call your congressperson, regardless of which direction you feel, today's the day to do it on the House side. But they could stop this bill, and it wouldn't, you know, the Republicans say, well, you'd be voting against tax cuts for the working class. No, you would be voting against this incredible transfer of wealth and incredibly high deficits and say, let's go back to the drawing board, because July 4th is an artificial deadline. They still have time to fix this bill. And how is Elise Stefanik going to run for governor when she votes for this bill that contains exploding deficits, that's going to trample on our clean energy? You know, we are emerging as a strong clean energy state, a strong chip state, a infrastructure, you know, we were moving forward with infrastructure improvements. And so she's not only voting for this bill, but she has been in complete lockstep with Trump. And what kind of record is that to run on?
I hope this doesn't sound cynical. I don't think of myself as a cynical person. But do you think that the way we are practicing politics now, that even matters? In other words, isn't it just tribal now? In other words, do you think 18 months from now voters are going to remember the big, beautiful bill and how their representative voted on it?
Living at it now, they don't know what the impact of this bill is going to be now because it's all proposed. But in 18 months, I think that's just the right amount of time to feel the pain.
Right. And they're not, it's not just the bill, because she is so all in on Trump. It's the whole range.
She's Stefanik.
Is so in on, you know, she is all in.
But that's reinforcing my point.
All in on Trump. But it's not just this bill. It's all of the other things. Because the Medicaid cuts, they delayed them until after the election. I think it's purposeful, because I know if their constituents find out how much they're going to be hurt by this bill, it's going to be a problem. But it's attacking, you know, all of these programs that attack farmers. Farmers are going to be in a world of hurt in this country, so much so they know that. So what did they do? They cut the SNAP programs because they needed to create a $60 billion fund to try to bail out farmers, because they know how bad this is going to be for them, right? So I do think that the repercussions of the very dramatic changes of withholding money. You have research universities, very important research universities all over New York State, and you've cut the research funding for those universities. If you've cut funding for infrastructure programs, pulled back funding that was awarded, you know, you're cheering on the person who's deporting immigrants that you need, that have not broken any laws, but you need them for your businesses, look at what the tariffs are doing on the Canadian, U.S.-Canadian border. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So the compounding impacts, I think, are a problem for her.
Back to the poll. I mean, if, you know, and I think we are in agreement on this.
I'm cynical about polls.
Well, pollsters have had a pretty bad run in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years or so. So, you know, I'm maybe not cynical, but I agree with you on your view of pollsters. But look, you'd rather be Hochul than not, back to this poll, because you'd rather have a D next to your name than an R when you're running for statewide office in New York. But if I were going to bet money I couldn't afford to lose, that's why I would assume, you know, I'd rather be Hochul than not. But let me be clear, I would not want to bet money that I could not afford to lose on the outcome of the gubernatorial race.
She absolutely is going to have to campaign hard, but I'd rather be on the side of investing in science and technology and innovation, which she's on the side of. I'd rather be on the side of investing in our clean energy economy, which she's... I'd rather be on the side of really investing in law enforcement. I mean, there are ways that they are, you know, they say about defunding the police. There are so many different ways that the Republican administration right now is defunding the police, and she is not on the side of that.
I would like to be on the side of people who vote policy as opposed to tribal affiliation. I hope to live long enough to see that come back.
But the problem is that truth-telling, that's a big problem, because this deportation thing, again, built on a fundamental lie.
A popular policy.
But it's a lie.
Okay.
It's built on a lie. But how long is it going to be?
Every time I'm on the roundtable, this is an 80-20 issue. 80% of voters in this country, including Democrats, support this president's immigration policy.
As Governor Hochul and Governor Pritzker and a number of other Democratic governors said, we too want to crack down on violent criminals. That is not what they're doing. Right? That they are deporting. I mean, right now, there's a family, a mother, a son, and a daughter in deportation. The son is 4 years old and he has cancer, and they're deporting him, and he's in a detention center. What's he doing there? They didn't do anything wrong. Why are we deporting people who came here from Afghanistan because they helped U.S. troops? And now The State Department has revoked their temporary protective status and they're sending them back. Why are we sending, you know, anyway, why are we, the deportation thing is about.
I mean, and that brings us.
I'm taking up too much time.
You're not good at being your own lawyer. I did it. I took the candy. I didn't give it back.
No.
I put it in, and then I gave it away to my brothers. And
this deportation, what's going on? Don't tell me this is an 80-20. I'm sorry. It's not. What is going on now with deportation is un-American. It is wrong, and we should all be talking about it and talking against it.
Mamdani be deported?
Oh, no. Come on. Come on.
Absolutely not.
That is not the deportation we should be talking about. We should be talking about... We should be talking about the deporting of the wife of the Marine. She was called in to go to a meeting. She has a 3-year-old and an 8-week-old. The Marine takes his wife to the meeting. They tell her there's a paperwork problem that was caused by her mother like 5 years ago or something. Okay, get it all set.
Okay.
I thought that was off. And what did they do? She walks out of the meeting. The ICE is there, and they arrest her, and now they're going to deport her. Why? Why in America are they doing that? What about the 75-year-old immigrant from Cuba, 75 years old, from Florida? He came here 60 years ago. He was put in a detention center, and he died.
Okay, fair.
Why was he there?
Fair. I just wanted to Robert's point, though. I just when you say that it's an 80-20 issue, and I agree, I understand that. I've read those polls, and I understand those polls. But that's different than when it's being used like this, when the president says, "Well, if I don't like what they're doing, I'm going to deport them."
Well, but that's ridiculous.
I know it's ridiculous, but if you're using it and saying it, and oh, by the way, you're the president, it does excuse the feel, okay. Doesn't it?
Another thing I say on the roundtable. All the time. Yeah. I am not an apologist for this president.
No. Right. I'm just saying it is, I think that is...
The lawsuits on directing a federal agency will catch up. It's just, it's the headline that he's going to take advantage of now.
Absolutely.
But can we please, okay, on the putative headline here, you know, where Mamdani is saying...
The
president's threatening him with deportation. Between now and the day I die, I'm going to write a book, and it's going to be called Everything I Need to Know I Learned Teaching Fifth Grade. And one of the things I learned teaching fifth grade is you don't reward attention-seeking behavior with attention. And that's all this is. This is Mamdani seeking attention. This is Trump seeking attention.
This is
not a serious conversation.
I don't disagree with you one bit.
We agree.
Hey, how about that? It took us 2 hours.
It's the end of the
day.
But we got there.
We got there.
Oh, what a good way to celebrate Independence Day.
All right.
Yes.
Perhaps for the last time.
Indeed. I'm kidding.
Teresa,
Robert, Bob, you're all wonderful. Thank you very much. We'll be back right after this.